Hello and welcome. My name is Johannes and I'm the host of this show. I'm here today with Giselle Velarde and we will be speaking about AI, about AI and music. She's an expert in these fields and also about the future of AI, the future, the kind of impacts it may have on society. So let me introduce you to Giselle so you have an idea of what we will be speaking about, because this will become clear in the process of the introduction as well. She has been leading and guiding engineering teams in machine learning and data science projects. She has been working on areas such as forecasting, anomaly detection, and fraud detection. She has also been teaching artificial intelligence, machine learning, and deep learning at Universidad Privada Boliviana since September 2020. She has published a white paper on forecasting with deep learning that you can find in the archives. I will have a link to that in the bottom. She is also the author of Artificial Era, an up-and-coming book about the predictions, problems, and diversity in AI that will be published at Oxford University Press. She has a PhD in computer science and engineering from Aalborg University in Denmark, where she developed machine learning and deep learning algorithms for music analysis, pattern discovery, and classification. She is also a pianist who studied at the Conservatorio Plurinacional de Música in La Paz, Bolivia. I'm sorry if I mispronounced this terribly.
That sounds great. That sounds fine.
And won several prizes at the National Piano Competition in Bolivia. She plays classical, contemporary, and Bolivian music and sometimes improvises on the piano. She has published a white paper on forecasting with deep learning that you can find on the archives, as I said before. She explains a method for time series forecasting with deep learning in its assessment on two data sets. She also provides the implementation of the method and experiments as open source code that you can download. She's the author of Artificial Era, a book that will be coming up on Oxford University Press in October. Is that right? I think it's in October. And I think you can pre-order it right now on Amazon, in
fact. That's right. Yeah.
We might be touching upon this book as well. I hope we will. And so she was also named a notable woman in artificial intelligence and music by the International Society for Music Information Retrieval in 2020. She was also selected internationally as one of 120 technologists by the Top Women Tech 2019 and 2020 Summit in Brussels. Welcome, Giselle. It is a great pleasure to have you on the show. Yes, let me just start with a question about music and AI. And that is, you know, how, you know, say data science, how do they interact in your life? How do you see, maybe, you know, there's of course, music is built up on mathematics and there are patterns that repeat in various ways, or echo rather, you know, each other in certain ways. And there's a great deal of that involved, and so it is also in data science, specifically when it comes to data, you know, when it comes to time series and musical time series that you studied as well. So how do they interact in your life now? How have they interacted in the past? And could you speak on that?
Sure. First of all, I'm very thankful, Johannes, that you invited me to chat about these topics here at your show. And I'm very happy also to chat with your audience or express my interest in AI and the future of AI, and also how music relates to data science and AI. The first thing is maybe just to say that music is one of the nicest things we as humans developed in our evolution. We have language, but we have other capacities, and music is perhaps a very specific task that humans perform and perform very well. So we can understand patterns, musical patterns and rhythmical patterns and harmonic, melodic, everything that help us to develop as humans. And we tried with machines to understand those patterns, those styles, and try to model them to either create music, to analyze music, and to perform different tasks that are relevant for music in general.
That's very interesting. To me, you know, to my mind, music is something that, or art in general, I would say, is something that comes out of consciousness, right? So it is something that it's an expression of some experience or some kind of emotions. So that's very, you know, it's always somewhat puzzling for me. I don't get very much out of listening to AI music, to be honest with you. So I wonder what that feels for you as a musician, as also a data scientist. We're both, I mean, I'm not a musician, but I am a huge, I've been a singer for many years, actually. So, and I'm a huge consumer of music, let's say it that way. And my children play music and so on. And in any case, you know, I can relate to both data science and music as well. So, for me, listening to AI music doesn't make any sense. How do you feel about that?
How do I feel about it? So maybe first thing about music, there are some theories that say that music is like a dessert, right? Why do we need music as humans? I mean, we don't really need music for communicating because we have language, or we don't need it for, I don't know, for performing any job or any specific task. But something that you pointed out is very important. Maybe music was developed to help us with emotion regulation and also as an expression of our capabilities. So there are many interesting theories why we are musical animals, and it's very interesting. The question is if AI music is interesting at all, yes or no. Well, it is interesting to say that the first thinkers that were thinking about automation always relate to music as a very important task of intelligence. And for example, talking about many, many millennia, Aristotle thought that we could have lyras playing their own chords, either at noticing our desire or just by doing so. So that's very interesting that even Aristotle was thinking that we could create autonomous music. That's very interesting because he was also talking about statues moving themselves. So he was actually thinking about automation in such a way, but music was always very important, maybe for human thinkers and for our evolution as a species. Later on, Ada Lovelace, who's the first programmer, she thought that analytical machines could create or could be used for any complex task, including creating music. So she envisioned the capability of intelligent algorithms to create music. That was interesting that also she related artificial intelligence with music and so on and so forth. So actually, and if you see the first algorithms that were developed with machines in the middle of the last century, also were intended to create music. So it's very interesting that we humans use machines to create music, but now we also use it to analyze. And in my case, I was in a project where we were trying to analyze and create music. It was sponsored by the European Commission. So we learned many things about this project. And I think today there are many projects trying to create music, for example, for games, because if you are playing, like, I don't know, 4 hours a day or 6 hours a day, and you listen the same music all the time, at some point you are bored and you need maybe new music that will react to your environment or to the moment that you're playing. So you need something that is, you know, like a real band playing at the moment. In that case, it's very interesting to have an algorithm creating the atmosphere for your precise moment. There are other applications for music creation, like trying to help composers, for example, develop in the style they have, like giving alternatives so they can decide how they want to create their music. And for example, we are now working on a project where I composed some music, and actually I invited some people to develop algorithms to put the orchestration on that music. So sound and timbre, how AI can help us create new sounds, and based on, for example, what kind of data we are learning from, and then we could create sounds from different eras and different epochs. So that's very interesting. And I think more and more this will be a tendency in music production as well.
That's really fascinating. And it's probably more and more also built into the usual music software, as it is with video software, also gets more and more little AI features built into it, right? So it's essentially just, is it just expanding our vocabulary as musical expression, in our own expression of music? Do you see it as that? Or do you see that the AI expresses something also?
Something, what you say, the last part?
The algorithm expresses something, or is it that we are expressing something more now using AI?
That's a philosophical question, I guess, Johannes. But because, okay, what is the intention of a composer? What the composer want to express? That's very difficult to define. That's something, of course, every composer has an intention. And maybe that is the question of what is true creativity. Can really algorithms be truly creative? Because humans have an intention. Do machines have an intention? If they do have an intention, maybe they are truly creative. But that's a more philosophical question. I mean, if you would, for example, just very objectively analyze what some algorithms create, you can be surprised on how creative they can be. The question is this truly creative? I mean, there was an intention from the algorithm to create this music, or is it just an algorithm? So the question is still open there.
Yeah, so this intentionality question, right? So there's a question of whether AI in general can possibly have its own intentions. And so that's also, I mean, as a data scientist, you sort of know that what we're doing is we have them optimizing some kind of function that we define, right? So there's always a human defining some function that shall be optimized. So in that sense... Yeah. So, but you could say that similarly, our intentions are also pre-programmed in a way, because there is some, you know, evolutionary function that we are optimizing, and it is also not really of our own making in that way.
I think you are true by saying that. So, for example, it could be that we humans are created to create music. Are you know, in our DNA is this kind of notion of that we have to create music and we have to be creative. And it's like if you compare with some species, the termites are very creative and they create wonderful buildings to have a fungus that they can eat, and this fungus is, you know, a special temperature, and they create, you know, buildings like they were architects and engineers for, you know, maintaining this fungus in a special temperature. They have a very important system, so some architects are studying this solution from the termites. So the question is, do termites create because they are creative? Is there an intention from the termites? So it's something that they do because it's their species. I don't know the answer about that.
Well, there's another interesting question there, and that is, are they creative as individuals, or are they creative only as groups? I think that the second one would have to be seen, right? And is that actually true of humans too? So this is not, you know, no one ever made up the blues, right? Nobody actually invented it, right? It is something that emerged. And it is true of any kind of music or any kind of style or any, well, there are of course these kind of made up styles that, you know, some record company thought we were going to make a style up. And that's a different thing. But most of the musical genres that are enduring are some that are not really coming out of the mind of one human being, right? They are reflections, or they are actually collective constructions. Don't you agree?
Yeah, completely. So we are social animals, and we have our different types of ceremonies. I think music started as a ceremony also, you know, because music and dance are very related. So there was something in our story or history that made us create music and rhythm and dance. So if you look at the initial cultures, you would say it's so important, dance and music and these rituals that we create as humans, that is impressive how we develop this kind of activity. And yeah, anything that we do, of course, you would say, okay, there are some creations that are only, you know, done by certain composers. But these composers learn from the past as well. So, yeah, it's difficult to say where is, you know, something that it was done only by you, but you are always influenced by many, many musics, many environments. So, yeah.
I mean, the moment that you play a piano, you are influenced by Johann Sebastian Bach, because that's the guy who tuned it for you, essentially. So it's, in many ways, it's, you know, there are some moments, I guess, like that in the case of Bach, for example, where it seems to be pivotal moment where everything changes after that moment. But also that moment has its seeds, obviously, in the past as well. There is nothing that actually has no seeds in the past. But I wanted to ask you something about ritual. Is a really great point, right? So when you follow that thought a little bit and say, okay, music probably came out of ritual, and then you think of AI, and you're thinking, AI doing rituals? It seems absurd, you know?
Well, the question maybe is artificial intelligence something close to what we understand as intelligence? So is really artificial intelligence close to what we understand as human intelligence or animal intelligence? Or biological intelligence, because you would say that there are different types of biological species that are very intelligent as well, but they have some kind of biological component. So, and we have computers that have circuits and electricity, which are different components as well. So today there are projects that are trying to study how to merge biological components with artificial intelligence. And I don't know what we will get out of those projects, but there is this difference, I guess, between what we expect from a biological entity different from a computer.
Is that because, so the episode before the last episode, I was talking to Neville Nui, and we were talking about these three different terms: intelligence, sentience, and consciousness. Mm-hmm. They appear to be quite different objects. So, for example, if you ask a Buddhist monk what is consciousness, they will say that you have to turn off your mind in order to get there. So in other words, intelligence then is maybe anti-correlated with consciousness, potentially. If you think of intelligence as the mind, as the thing that does the computations, mm-hmm. because apparently we do, when we build AI, we think of intelligence, then that means that we think of a sort of computational form, right? But if it's not tied to consciousness, meaning there is no way, you know, so let's say ChatGPT, there is no way that it feels like to be ChatGPT, right? There is a way that it feels like being Giselle. There is a way that it feels like being Johannes, or even being a bat, or being a dog, or a donkey. That all makes sense to us. Maybe even a termite. But the ChatGPT, suddenly you see this disconnect, and I think it may just be there, right? It may be this consciousness thing. And then there's this other term, sentience, over which I think one of the Google engineers who said that, I think he used that term, the one who was fired for saying that one of the large language models was sentient. And then I think he was rehired. I don't know the whole drama stuff.
I don't know what the meaning of sentient is. Can you explain that?
I mean, to me, what it means, so I cannot really, I think these things are all quite ill-defined, but I think sentient means to be alive as opposed to dead, okay. Not all alive. Right. I think that's what it means. I mean, that's my own understanding. If anyone is out there wants to correct me on this, you know, I think that's what it means. So being alive and not being alive. And then consciousness is, of course, you know, this sense of being, having this thing that it feels like being, you know, Johannes, right? There's this moment of feeling, like I feel the wind on my face. That's called a qualia, you know, an experience. But it is, there is someone there who feels the wind. You know, there's a subject inside of the body that is maybe an object.
In this sense, but maybe we are entering into areas where I am not an expert. But for example, I think viruses are not alive, but they can reproduce, right? Is this correct?
Yeah, I think that's right, yeah.
Right, so that's interesting. For example, I think a virus has a purpose, even though it's not alive, and its purpose is to reproduce. So that's, yeah, I don't know, very interesting. But in terms of consciousness, what you said is completely right. So if you ask a Buddhist monk about consciousness, this person will tell you, you have to stop thinking, and then you will reach this state of consciousness. But there is another yogi that tells us that actually consciousness is something that we can perhaps not understand humans as humans. So it's something that it's beyond our understanding, and consciousness is something very big that we may not understand with our mind, even with our mind. So it could be that, I don't know, a stone is also conscious, and maybe we do not understand this consciousness. In that case, we could say, yeah, maybe a computer program is also conscious, because there is another theory that says that consciousness relates to experience. So if you have an experience and you're aware of this experience, then you're conscious. Even babies are conscious, and other animals are conscious. So conscious, and if you are through an experience, an algorithm learns from experience. So you would say, well, the machine is conscious because it has an experience and it's conscious, but it's not the same consciousness as we experience.
And so or even the same kind of experience, right? It's just a calculation. It's numbers.
It's sort not of the same experience. I mean, yeah, a computer can tell you, I'm looking at an ice cream, but the computer never tasted the ice cream, never had the chemical reaction that we have when we eat an ice cream. So it's not right. The same experience.
Yeah, so it doesn't really know what ice cream is. It can sort of tell you how it works in language, you know, how ice cream fits into, or even a little bit deeper, I think it's a bit deeper to say that, you know, where ice cream fits into our linguistic, you know, when to expect the phrase ice cream, you know when it's hot on a hot day or something like that, when someone says it's a hot day, it might expect there could be ice cream, right? It because it now has these correlations, it sort of understands correlations in a way. It's a correlation machine.
It creates an understanding of what we train this to understand, but yeah. It will never have the same experience as we do. It's like we cannot know how butterflies look because they have other hardware, and they can spot different colors that we are not able to spot. So the experience of a butterfly, of seeing the world, is very different from our experience.
Indeed. John Searle is a philosopher on this topic of consciousness. He says that he thinks that something in our brain produces this experience of what it feels like to be us, and that we could possibly understand it, but we're not there, right? Maybe we're not looking at the right place. Maybe we're not even looking in the right way at the brain. We're looking at the firing of neurons, which may be involved in intelligence, which may be a different dimension from, you see, but maybe the way that we think of human intelligence is intelligence plus consciousness, plus this experience that we're talking about, right? So if we combine all of what ChatGPT can do with the feelings aspect, then we might be there. But this feeling aspect is really elusive, and we don't know how it works.
But But as I said, so ChatGPT does not have the same hardware as we have. So ChatGPT have the human body. They don't have the same chemical reactions that we have. ChatGPT's experience will never be the same as our experience. No. And we will not have also the understanding of what GPT, what it feels to be ChatGPT, you know, because we don't have circuits. We are not plugged into electricity, so that's something that we cannot know.
But you think there is something that it feels like to be ChatGPT? That's interesting.
I'm just telling you that we cannot know what it feels to be ChatGPT, and ChatGPT cannot know what it feels to be us. We cannot know what it feels to be a butterfly, and butterfly cannot know what it feels to be us. So that's, we have different hardwares. We have, we are created in a different way. So I don't know. That's a philosophical question.
It's really interesting, because there are some people who claim that maybe with virtual reality, we can come really close to give you an experience of what it might feel like to be a butterfly. I mean, I think it is a bit far-fetched. It may not be possible. But if it is technically possible, it'd be a very interesting thing, because potentially we could have more empathy for other living beings, right? So I think there is also this question, this very practical question of why is it that we destroy everything in our path? It may be related to the fact that we can't relate enough to it.
Yeah, why we do some things if we are so intelligent? That's a great question, Johannes.
Do you think AI can help us with that? Become more intelligent in that way? If we apply it correctly?
If we could become more intelligent thanks to AI? At the moment, I don't know how. Because how we develop intelligence, in our case, I think it's through training. So if we we are trained to do something, we create some connections in our brain. Even if we, you know, if we train for sports, we need our body, you know, to exercise the muscles. If we want to, I don't know, play the piano, we have to spend some hours to create those connections in our brain. So the way we develop intelligence is by training, by doing things. So in that case, maybe artificial intelligence can help us to optimize the way we learn. That could be a possibility. Yeah.
But also, I mean, in a general sense, like what we were saying, you know, the sustainability question, maybe it can draw correlations out for us, causational paths, and help us. Even there's this idea that if you can immerse yourself into a more richer ecosystem for a moment to know what that would look like, say one location that you see, you could maybe use technology to allow people to understand. You know, there is this problem. It was described in a book called Rebirding as an ecological tidiness disorder that people have. You know, so people want things to be tidy and clean and neat in the environment as they do at their home.
I think,
and that's a problem.
What you suggest, some people may see it like manipulating human nature, optimizing to some result. So I think, of course, we want better humans in our world. What is the best way to make humans better, and that the objectives are also according to protecting our world, protecting other species, and protecting ourselves? How do we reach that? I think I'm more into say we need more education to develop that path for humans, and either be with artificial intelligence, with, I don't know, better educational systems and efforts from governments and so on and so forth. There are many ways to think in that. So I think it's a big effort to develop us as a better species.
Yeah, the fine line between education and manipulation, right? Because you could say, learning how to read, now you can manipulate yourself or something like that, or you will be manipulated by all the people who you read, who are more persuasive than others, right? So even language itself, you could think of as a form of manipulation, subtle in that way, don't you think?
Well,
so manipulation is a hard...
We need to create critical people that are able to discriminate and take decisions from themselves. and understand what will help us to develop as species or not. And I think that's only coming through education. So this critical thinking can come from your parents, that can come in the school, that can come in the university. But that thing, that's a critical thinking that we need to develop.
But is it not also true? Okay, that I agree. So maybe the question is more of a semantic difference to say that maybe part of education could be to immerse yourself into things you have not experienced that could be there, that are not there, you know, so that allows you to be actually more critical in a way, because right now you see the world as it is. But if we now show you some possibilities of how what it could be like if we did X, Y, Z, or whatever, then you can be more critical. And maybe you can say, well, no, because of this and the other.
100%.
Or you can say, well...
Yeah, I mean, I think experience shapes us. And also, for example, exposure to different cultures, how people live in different places around the world. Maybe we live thinking that the world is the way we see it. And we go somewhere else and we discover, the world, there are different worlds in this world. So there are different ways how people live and how they experience life and objectives in their lives. So, and if you can do it with technology, you know, if you don't need to travel to Africa to understand how people live there, then you put your sunglasses and then you get experience in that moment and you reflect on yourself and you say, oh, maybe I need to do something. So I think it's wonderful. Yeah.
But then that brings me to the question. So that was maybe the original purpose of the internet to some degree, even, right? So to expose you to different cultures, different points of view and so on. And then what happened is this commercialization or whatever happened, it's described by various philosophers, various observers. There is, Shoshana Zuboff, who writes about surveillance capitalism. So there AI is used ultimately to make us dumber in a way, because it is used to optimize, engagement, which then will expose us to the most outrageous things, mostly negative things, because that's where we like to engage with us as unfortunate, maybe human quality. I don't know, if you show us something outrageous, something horrible, we're more likely to engage with it. And so then because of that, AI essentially engineered a worse society where we're all exposed to outrageous content constantly. And our mind, in a way, degrades, you know, and this could also happen in a more vivid thing. So I'm always worried about these two things. I think that there's a lot of potential and that there's a lot of things that could go wrong. How do you think about this? Also, is that related to what you're writing in your book? Because you're making some predictions about AI and, could you speak a little bit about that also maybe in the context of your upcoming book, The AI Era?
Of course. So actually, I think that technology is just a tool, and you can use a tool for many purposes. For example, with a knife, you can eat your lunch, or you can save the life of someone. So a doctor can save the life of someone, and you can kill someone with the same knife, with the same tool. So it's how we use technology in our daily life, and we actually give the purpose. So if we are talking about intelligence and purpose, we just have tools, and these tools will either help us or not help us. So it depends on how we use the technology. So it's very dependent.
Yeah, I agree with that. Absolutely. This is actually sort of along the ways that I've been preaching it as well. So it's good to hear it from someone else, who has been thinking about this as well very hard. So could you give us maybe a little bit of a summary? So your book has three parts, is that right? So like a present, past, and then it starts obviously with the past, present, and then future. So could you give us a little bit of a summary, what to expect from your book, and what a little bit?
Sure. So thank you for asking. Actually, the book has five chapters. The first chapter, it's called the artificial cataclysm, because I think we are going through a new chapter also. And this has been studied by many scholars, that we are in these waves of development or technological progress. So you can see in the book in which stage of this wave are we. Then it's another chapter on how, for example, technology has been used from people working in a garage, and now they are, you know, great entrepreneurs, and they have large companies, how they develop in such a short time. I think in history we haven't seen that before. So technology, even internet and phones, are helping us to develop innovations in a very, very fast time. The third chapter, I study why there are so few females in AI. So that's something that strikes me. And there are many statistics on this. The fourth chapter is about education in humans. So what develops our own humankind? And there is also some studies on, for example, there was new tendencies on transhumanists, that they want to use technology to create better humans. And the question is, what do you mean by better humans? So we come back to your question, how we develop as humans, what help us to develop as humans. So that is in the fourth chapter. And then the last one, there are some predictions that I'm taking also from some authors that they are analyzing what is going to happen, what happened in the past. That's correct what you say. So if you want to make a prediction, you want to analyze the past and see if there is a pattern that will repeat or not. But in reality, if you are in forecasting, for example, you know that many times the future is unpredictable. So something that happened in the past may never have happened and will occur in the future. So we never have seen something like that and will happen. Of course, some things of the past may repeat, like there are structures that will happen in the past and we can predict, oh, based on that, what is going to happen in the future. For example, just a simple example. So some people are worried about being displaced by automation, many jobs, and many people will lose their jobs, and so on and so forth. What happened in previous revolutions is indeed some people lost their job, but many jobs were created, and there are many new inventions, and people needed to create those inventions. So although these jobs will be lost, some other activities will create and will bring more innovation as well. So there is a debate about what will happen if everything is automated, who is going to lead in this run to acquire AI and technology and so on and so forth. So I hope the book is exciting for you.
Yeah, it sounds really exciting. So one thing that I'm, you know, when we were speaking earlier also about making better humans and making humans better, and in some ways I agree, but there's also a really dangerous strand of this kind of thinking, right? The eugenics movement and people who are even in AI today, or thinking in AI philosophy, there's Nick Bostrom, who I think has, you know, some really dangerous ideas there in this direction. And he also has fears that I find myself personally unfounded. I don't know. What do you think? Do you think that there are some? Do you give any credence to the sort of existential risks that he's talking about? Are you familiar with those?
Yeah, of course. Well, it's very interesting that you ask this, because in the book there is actually a survey, and I collected 180 answers from AI communities asking this question. So people expect a great future, like a utopian future where everything is going to be fantastic, or are we expecting a very terrible future thanks to AI and all the technologies combined together? There is another question. I mean, this survey has 4 or 5 answers, and I asked people to respond to that. So the utopian one, the dystopian one, the pragmatic one, where you see innovation and growth, economic growth. But of course, if enterprises and companies and countries do not take the technologies at the moment, they may lack and may leave behind those that are taking the technology. So the gaps may widen as well. And the other one is, you know, skeptical, so they don't think AI is close to intelligence as we understand it. So you can see the results. Most people felt pragmatic, so most people in AI communities felt we are not perhaps going to see the utopian world and not even the dystopian one, but they are more pragmatic. Probably because those that respond are working with algorithms. They see day to day what is really happening behind and what can you achieve with algorithms.
That's interesting. I personally have seen sort of both, right, at the same time, utopian and dystopian situations. So, you know, for example, the stuff that Shoshana Zuboff is speaking about is actually quite real. I think the same thing is also true of, you know, what Timnit Gebru is speaking about, you know, the sort of large model parrot, stochastic parrot problem, right? So there are some problems that, you know, you could have AI start, you know, doing things or saying, like, let's say, discriminate against certain people in their decision, in the decision making process, or what it says or speaks about or whatever. And you could, you know, have situations where, for example, very embarrassing, I think, for Google, where, you know, African American people were identified as gorillas and things like that. So those are dystopian things to my mind. But at the same time, you have utopian things happening as well. What happens in the healthcare area, where we can really do things to eliminate suffering. And that is, in a way, to me, utopian. So these are realistic things. They don't seem like much, but if you can eliminate cancer for the person who has it, it's huge. It's an enormous utopian kind of thing, right? And similarly, if something happens where you are identified as a gorilla, as a person, you know, and that's also dystopian. It's extremely, it's awful. And you know, anyway, and then, you know, in the criminal justice system, the way it could be used, it could actually lock people up who have done no crime. And that, again, is, to me, a dystopian outcome, right? So I feel like we have both. What do you think
mix? Yeah, you're completely right, Johannes. So actually, in my book, I argue that we live in a surreal technological progress. So there are some fantastic things that we see and some advancement that you would not believe that are happening. And at the same time, there are things that are completely bizarre. And you say, yeah, this is surreal. So from one hand, you see wonderful advancement. And from the other hand, you see problems like the one you described. And actually, this is a problem, I guess, a systematic problem that the AI community is very homogeneous. And to overcome those problems of bias in systems, we need diverse teams. So including the population of the world in those AI development teams, because we as humans have our own biases, and that's normal because those are created through experience. And if you are you know, through an environment which is always the same, well, your hypothesis at developing algorithms will be also framed by that, not because you are a bad person or you want to create harm, but it's because the way we are. So if we want to prevent systems from being biased, or prevent systems that only give advantage to some groups of people, we need to include into these development teams more diverse generations and backgrounds and everything. So we need to work on that in AI. I think that's the only way to overcome those problems.
Yeah, I fully agree. This is actually what my show is a little bit about. I'm trying to bring perspectives from all over the world, from different types of people who are working in either working in technology, or are philosophers regarding technology, or are involved in some way or the other in this discussion, to bring them here and talk about these topics. Exactly, because I think exactly you're right. You know, we need to also talk about it, not just, you know, have them in there working and maybe talking to each other, but also making it clear to the public as well, so that people know, you know, what are different people thinking about when they're working in this area. What do they see on the ground? I think it's really important for even the public. You know, we talk a lot about politics in the public sphere, but I think that technology is starting to influence us in, or affect us in ways that might be even more important and enduring than a particular politician or a particular law in one or the other place. And it's affecting all of us, right? So I think we have to start talking about it as well. What do you think of that? And I guess your book is a great contribution to this as well.
I think my book is a contribution because I am a minority in AI, and I see perhaps things from other perspectives that most scholars do not see. It's related to what we were just talking about, right? So how we create different views, it's because you have different experiences, you come from different parts of the world, and you see the world from a different perspective. Of course, I have my own biases as well. But I see perhaps these blind spots where other researchers do not see because they are not exposed to the same challenges as I am, for example, coming from a minority. And so if we, for example, in my case, I would think we are always worried about optimization and machine learning, trying to discover better algorithms to solve certain problems. But I think technology is just a mirror. If you go to any AI conference and you see the participants, there is a lack of diversity. And of course, all innovations that will be created will lack also of this enrichment of diversity. So I think AI needs to develop in that area more than keeping technical. I think AI is doing a lot of job on that. So, for example, large conferences are including, for example, sessions for minorities as well. So trying to attract people and so on and so forth. But the problem may be bigger than that because, of course, access to education is limited as well. Access to funding is limited. So maybe there is a large project that needs to be taken cross countries to help develop this AI community, which is a responsibility now from all citizens in the world because we are not all connected.
Yeah, I agree. So let's, do you see some beginnings of that? Do you see some place where people can start connecting right now and starting to work toward that? Maybe Kaggle started to do something like that, right? Maybe there are some efforts, right, in this direction, also educational ones, I would say.
There are efforts, Johannes. So there are efforts. As you say, there are, for example, mentoring clubs. They are trying to include more minorities to AI conferences. But I think there are some problems that are systematic from countries that have never had access before, and they are now trying to access the AI race or the AI competition. For example, I come from a country in Bolivia, and we don't have an artificial intelligence strategy. So the government does not realize that we need an artificial intelligence strategy. And that said, my country would need, for example, that some experts come and they try to develop knowledge in the country so that we fast try to catch up with the technology. But this is not happening. So in some countries, as I said, we need perhaps more collaboration international from the leaders to notice that, yeah, some countries are not using the technology for now, and they're not participating of the AI party at the moment. So that's needed perhaps in a collaboration with big leaders and institutions.
Is it possible at all for people from Bolivia to participate across boundaries? Is it, you know, because there is, okay, so this is interesting because it also relates to this other concept of democratization of AI, which has been critiqued on this show before by Dorothea Bauer, who thinks it's just a commercial thing, you know, where these evangelists, technology evangelists who name themselves that, which is really, I think, a problematic term, and I think she's right about that. But to make it easier to access AI, to work with algorithms on the Google Cloud or AWS, I think also has an advantage, right? So it does allow people in Bolivia to play around with it and see what they can do and load up some data and run some algorithms and detect things and predict things, right? What do you think of this tension?
We have the technology to do it. The technology now allows us to communicate, you know, per Zoom, and I can talk to students in Bolivia and I can supervise them. But I think artificial intelligence is like any other trade. So you learn by doing and you learn from someone who knows how to do it. I mean, if you want to be a baker, you go to a bakery and then you see with your own eyes and you do the bakery with someone who has, I don't know, 15, 20 years experience doing the bakery thing. And they tell you, oh, look, do this different and it will bake much better. So that's what we need for AI, because you can be lost. There is so much information on the internet. There are so many data sets. There are so many advances. But if you don't have this help of someone who can teach you, can guide you. It's very difficult to produce anything that's worth doing. So that's, I think that's the main problem. So this collaboration, because people are eager to learn, they are smart as well. The technology allows us to, you know, use algorithms to develop innovations. But I think, yeah, it's difficult to create this large project, as you would say, to help develop countries in the world that do not have the expertise.
Yeah, I see. So mentoring is really the shortage. There's a shortage of mentoring. Maybe in a more immersive environment, in a more immersive future of, you know, now I don't know if you've seen the Vision Pro has come out by Apple, and you know, it allows you to be sort of immersed in various ways. And I wonder, can that help you gain access to perhaps mentors who might work pro bono to help people understand algorithms? Or maybe there will be some sort of, you could say, almost like an international help desk for aspiring data scientists to do something. Do you think this is a possibility, or is this?
That would be wonderful, Johannes. So if we would have collaboration, international collaboration, that would be fantastic. I have been teaching in my country online, and I supervise students, but of course my time is limited. I cannot take, I don't know, hundreds of students. So some way it could be developed, some collaboration could be developed to massively help develop this expertise in countries where, you know, they don't have these experts on site, right? So technology can allow us to do many things, but I think it's a matter of budgets, how you allocate that. And perhaps, you know, people would say, yeah, I do it because I'm a nice person. But many people also would need, you know, recognition, and you need the budget to help develop projects. So there is the interest, of course, from countries that need to be aware that is this possibility of develop fast. So yeah, it's a not so easy topic, I would say. I mean, from the technical part, you can solve it, but it's more about how to collaborate.
Well, so that brings me to a more personal view on this. How did you do it? So you went and did it, right? So you're a very seasoned data scientist now, and expert on the subject of AI, and you've written a book that will be published by Oxford University Press. So how did you do that? You grew up in Bolivia. Could you give maybe some people can take some inspiration from your own experience?
I was very lucky, Johannes, because I had in my family, I had the opportunity to have a great education. And I think that's luck. So you either are born in a place where you get the tools to develop or not. So I was very, very lucky to have all this support from my family, from my parents to study, to, you know, study music and to study at the university engineering. So I think that's not everybody has this luck to go through good education in countries where, you know, education is not free, right? In some countries you have to pay for education, and it's not and it's expensive, so you have to afford to pay that. But after that, I was also lucky. I got an internship, so I came to Germany thanks to an internship. And then I started working. I got another internship for my PhD in Aalborg in Denmark. And I can say I'm very happy and very glad that all those things happened to me. So I'm a lucky person. But I think the system needs to help those that are not in the same position. So in my eyes, everybody can develop. Everybody has the potential to reach places, but they need this support from childhood to get access to good education. And that's, of course, not the case for everyone. So this is a large system that would need to help everyone to have the same possibilities to achieve the same goals or personal goals.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think that AI and massive online courses can bridge somewhat of the gap, and maybe they could be augmented in clever ways? And also, what would you say to someone who might not feel so lucky, or who might feel that they do want to do something, they have the drive? And I also feel that, you know, that I know I have this feeling that may not be true, that if you have the drive to do something, there's always a chance that you can do it. It's not guaranteed. It may not work, but to go for it, right, is something you should try anyway, because it may actually work. And if, you know, I don't know, what is your feeling about that? Do you think people should aspire to becoming data scientists in Bolivia, for example? And what should they do if their educational background might in the past not have been so good, and to catch up?
Well, as I said, thanks to technology now, you can watch an online course from the best professors from the best universities on the world about artificial intelligence, and they are freely available. So you could learn, if you know English. Of course, you need English to see those lectures. But I'm talking about those people who really didn't have the opportunity to even finish primary school. So in some countries, education is not accessible to everybody in the same way, and that's a pity, right? So there are some countries and rural areas where kids do not have access to libraries, they don't have access to even computers. So 50% of the world population do not have a computer at home. So that's something that strikes us, perhaps those who are, you know, connected to the internet almost 24 hours a day.
I had one guest over here named Ananya Agrawal, who was in the Himalayas, and she built this educational platform that allows people to educate themselves on how to build businesses, you know, useful businesses that they can make money from. So it's very much like that, but in an innovative way. And they can help each other to sort of learn from each other what materials work and what not and so on. All with a very low cost way. They can call into some 800 number or something like that with their dumb phone, actually. So she built this, you know, in mind with all of these limitations that you're talking about, and she created something, and I find that really impressive, to say that, you know, to repeat, I guess, you know, that there was a whole show on this, but you think that this could be done, that we can just sort of inch our way up by building things where they're not available, by just, because we can't just wait for governments to, if they're not functional, if What do you think of this? There's a political aspect to this as well, right? So if governments just don't work for the people, can we just wait around for them, or is there something we can do to bypass them and work it out anyway?
There are fantastic projects. Just the one you described, it sounds great. I am aware also of other projects that, for example, are done in Ecuador, where people created computers using Raspberry Pi, I think, and they took all televisions. So they implemented this Raspberry Pi and this old television. So they were taking two projects in one. So taking old equipment that will be thrown to the trash, and use it as computers, very cheap computers, so people can access, for example, information where there are no libraries available or internet connection. So that sounds perfect to me for those who are, you know, not connected to the internet or do not have access to information. So I think entrepreneurs will find ways to help develop the current status of our world. I'm very positive about it. I'm positive about the new generations, always talking about the planet, always talking about making it a positive change. So I think we are going to see wonderful projects in the future, helping those who are in need. And hopefully soon we will see develop different communities as well with the pace. So I think we are going to see great advancement. But how fast it will allow everyone to access technology, it's hard to predict, hard to say.
Yeah. Yeah. And then and one more question about the environment. You think that AI and machine learning, you know, they use a lot of electricity and they're used for various purposes. But it seems to me that they're used more for clean energy, for example, than they're used for petroleum companies. So this is something, you know, I found out recently. So I think this is actually quite a positive thing. And then the question then is, like, you know, can we deploy these algorithms to create a more reciprocal relationship between ourselves and the rest of the ecosystem? Do you think that we can use that to, in that way?
What I have seen is that in conferences like NeurISP, now researchers are asked to provide information of how much electricity they were using with their algorithms, how many hours they trained, and so on and so forth. Because with deep learning, you can, you know, spend days and hours to train your models. And so at some point, of course, it's nice to see the developments of deep learning, but we need to be conscious of, okay, how much energy are we using for training an experiment? Is this worth doing this experiment again? I mean, you need to be conscious also of the planet. So I think, I don't know, I'm not aware of the other project, but I think that's one measure that NeurISP has taken to, you know, make researchers aware of how much energy they are using for their experiments. So there are other algorithms which are very cheap in terms of computing resources. So maybe that's also another solution to the problem of energy, looking into other algorithms which are, you know, more efficient in terms of computation. So that's also another possibility.
That's great. I wanted to ask you some other questions, but I don't think we have the time for this. So maybe could you just give the audience one sort of an important takeaway from this discussion that you think that they should keep in mind as they walk away from it? What should they hold on to?
What they should hold on to? Be conscious about your potential, how you are contributing to make this a better place. And I am very thankful for the questions, Johannes, and for this invitation. I had a great time talking to you, exploring these ideas, which are very exciting. And I'm very glad that you invited me.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. How can the audience stay in touch with you? Is there any way that they, what's the best way to find out what you're up to, what your research is on, and what your thoughts are, and upcoming books and other things?
You can find me online. If you search for my website, it's gvelarde.com. You can also check my LinkedIn profile. I have different networks. I'm in YouTube and Facebook, Instagram. So you can reach me online. And of course, you can look at the new book, Artificial Era. I'm very proud that it was it's going to be published by Oxford. So for me, that's I am in the sky because of that. So I'm very happy about it. And thank you again for having me here.